This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, there are certain areas of science that get lots of attention. Lots of attention to medicine, climate change, space, to name a few. And then there are other areas you hardly ever hear about them. For example, acoustics, the science of sound. That's one of them. When was the last time you heard about research in acoustics? Well, hopefully we're going to fill that gap in this hour. This week here in New York, the Acoustical Society of America held its annual meeting, and scientists presented research on a wide array of sound-related topics. Some of them join us today to talk about what's happening in their field. For example, how imaging technologies are being used to figure out how marine mammals like whales and dolphins, how they hear, and whether some of the underwater sounds we humans create can be damaging to their health. Also, how infants start learning language at a very early age, even in their first 6 months of life. They can tell the difference between sounds used in all languages. Could that explain why young children seem so adept at learning foreign languages and why adults find it harder to do so? And from human speech development to classroom acoustics, how excessive noise in and around classrooms can interfere with learning and teaching. And a new national standard that aims to create the best listening environment for all students, hearing impaired or not. That's what we're going to be talking about this hour and more. So if you would like to join our discussion about acoustics, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can always surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Patricia Kuhl is the co-author of The Scientist in the Crib, Minds, Brains, and How Children Learn. She's the co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences and a professor of speech and hearing sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. She joins us from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kuhl.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. David Lubman is the president of David Lubman and Associates in Westminster, California. He's an acoustical science consultant, and he's right here in our Science Friday studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Darlene Ketton, assistant professor in the Department of Otology and Laryngology at Harvard Medical School in Boston, and senior scientist in biology at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. She joins us from our NPR New York Bureau. Welcome to the program, Dr. Ketton.
Hi, thanks for asking
Thank
me.
Thank you. Patricia Kuhl, you were one of the meeting's organizers. What are some of the more interesting topics? We don't normally talk about acoustics.
Well, we're very serious about sound and all of its aspects. And one of the sessions I ran that I thought was really interesting was to give the young people of the society a chance to speculate about the future. And so nine of them stood up, each only having 9 minutes, and told us all kinds of exciting things that we're likely to be studying and hearing about in the next 25 years, before our 100th birthday in 2029. We heard, for example, that we might be seeing noise labels on various things. We've all gotten used to looking at nutritional labels that track fats and carbohydrates. And this young woman was suggesting, why not a noise label that specifies the dose that your hairdryer provides or that car alarm outside or the jackhammer down the street?
Very interesting. Guesses. Are these just proposals? Do they have any weight behind them, or are they just ideas?
There's considerable research backing the study of noise and its effects on people, and we're getting more sophisticated about understanding the various frequency components of various noises and how the cacophony of noise that we're now experiencing every day may affect us. In fact, Mayor Bloomberg in New York is very interested in the topic of noise. Mm-hmm. But not only noise, it's the medical use of sound. There are new techniques using ultrasound to stop bleeding of wounds that could be very useful in the war-torn countries that we know exist across the world.
Using sound to stop bleeding.
Yes, using ultrasound to halt bleeding and using ultrasound to bombard a tumor and shrink its mass. These are all very new forefront areas in which sound is being used in various ways to improve the lives of people. Mm-hmm. So we not only do concert hall acoustics, making music more pleasant for people around the world, sound is used in a variety of ways to improve our lives.
Interesting. David Lubman, your interest in archaeological acoustics began on a tour of the Mayan pyramid. Give us the story behind that.
I went there as a tourist in 1998, and with the rumors that there were strange acoustics around Mayan sites, and focused in at one of them at the Temple of Kukulkan at Chichen Itza. That's about a three-hour drive from Cancun. And found there was a chirped echo from the staircase, the long staircase at that temple.
You mean if you walk down the staircase, there was an echo?
No, if you stand in the great plaza in front of the temple and clap your hand, as the guides did, there'd be a chirped echo, kind of a beep. Very strange echo. And I puzzled over it, being an architectural acoustician. It didn't take me long to figure out basically what caused it, you know, the physics. Mm-hmm. But then I wondered what purpose it might have. I recorded the sound and compared it with the primary call of the sacred bird after which the temple is named, the Quetzal, although in the Mayan language they call it Kukul. And it's a very good match. Mm-hmm. And it's now my deep suspicion that this was intentionally designed. It could be, in a sense, the first recorded sound in human history.
I mean, they designed the architecture of the temple to create that sound? That must mean they had very sophisticated... It would take a long time to design that and test it and go back and do it over and over again.
And there's a huge economic investment in making that pyramid. And so no doubt they tried it elsewhere and worked it out before they committed themselves to this enormous investment.
All right. Let's have a listen. We have some audio clips here that will you'll hopefully describe the sound. Let me play this first clip now. That is?
Yeah, that is the Quetzal in its natural environment, the cloud forest. Chichen Itza is not in the cloud forest. This is hundreds of miles away from the cloud forest, which is the only place any respectable Quetzal would live. Mm-hmm. And so it's so important to their culture that they carried the memory of the Quetzal wherever they went.
Let's hear the next sound. What was that?
The first two was an actual Quetzal chirp, and the second two was the chirped echo that you get when you clap your hands.
Let's hear that again.
Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah. So do we suspect that there might be other pyramids or other kinds of buildings that have sounds like these built into them?
We found a number of sound effects, you might say, at Mayan sites, and we've only really just begun to look. But it's now my opinion that all Mayan temples with long staircases would chirp in response to a hand clap, especially when they were new and covered with hard plaster. But at Chichen Itza, it's post-classic, and so it's relatively modern, and it hasn't deteriorated that much yet. Hmm. But some of the other classic and pre-classic temples have deteriorated so badly that one hardly notices the chirp.
Interesting. Darlene Catton, you presented some research this week about dolphin and bat sonar. How are they similar or different? Tell us about that, please.
Right. One of the problems, well... People, if they think about when they look at bats, one of the most obvious features are these things that scientists call pinnae, what we commonly call our ears, the external flaps we have. Obviously, those are big ears on bats, and if you then look at a dolphin, your first response is, look, Ma, no ears. But we do know that both bats and dolphins are very acute hearers and very good, particularly at what's called localizing sound, detecting from which angle where the sound is. So one of my first projects was to find out how sound gets into that head, into a whale or dolphin head. And what imaging has shown us is that there are very special fats inside the dolphin head that run alongside their jaws, connect with their ears. And what the scanner lets us do is reconstruct those. What it showed us is that the fats look just like giant rabbit ears, in fact, just like giant bat ears. So what we've got is... a bat on scuba, to some extent.
They're sort of tucked away, then, the ears.
They're tucked deep inside their head, and they also use these same fats. The protruding forehead is really a fatty body called a melon. Uh-huh. It's made of the same fats, and these fats are matched to water. So in about 50 million years of evolution, they managed to stuff a bat head inside a dolphin. Huh. And underwater, they do just as well as bats do in air.
Maybe better. Wow. Do they use the same frequencies, the bats and the dolphins?
No, and that's another interesting thing. One thing that keeps me going in my area of science is that what I look at are sensory systems. Essentially, it's the watchmaker's kids approach to science. I take apart things in order to find out. Now, these are volunteers. It's a sad case when an animal strands, but it also gives scientists an excellent opportunity to understand more about animals that we're just never going to be able to readily observe directly or test directly, as you mentioned in your introduction. Mm-hmm. So with a stranded animal, when it dies, a lot of people working on different sensory systems or body organs try to make as much use as possible, as much science information as possible out of that animal. So what we do is to look at something like the dolphin head and try to figure out how it's put together.
Mm-hmm. And today, bats and the dolphins don't have the same frequency response.
No, what they did is, as they got bigger underwater, more fats protecting them, their heads getting bigger, their ears moved apart. What they did is to modify that head so that it accommodates the speed of sound in water, which is 4.5 times what it is in air. A dolphin that, in a sense, wants to hear something, to echolocate with biosonar something the same size as, say, a bat would in air, has to have a frequency capacity that's 4.5 times greater, higher, than what a bat does. Hmm. Bats are looking at small fish, typically, rather than at moths.
Right.
Therefore, they don't go quite that high. But, for instance, most bats will hear up to around 60 or 70 kilohertz, 60 or 70,000 cycles per second. Many dolphins hear up to 200,000 cycles per second. Commonly, many of them hear up to about 150,000 cycles per second. To put that in perspective, humans, we only hear at best, at absolute best, 20,000. Most mm-hmm. of us only up to 16,000 until you get to about age 18. And everybody knows this, your hearing starts to roll off and you start losing a lot of it.
And so how much better, I mean, can they hear a much wider range of sounds? If we humans, for example, can hear 8 octaves, what can a dolphin hear?
Perfect example. One thing is it's very difficult. There is no single sound bite for dolphins. Mm-hmm. There are 76 species. They all hear something somewhat different. Many of them hear at least 10 octaves, some of them possibly 12 octaves. We talk about sound, of course, as being sonic, meaning what ranges of frequencies humans hear. There are whale species that hear infrasonic down to about 10 hertz compared to our best 50 hertz. And then, as we've just been talking about, there are toothed whales, the predatory ones that echolocate, that hear, again, up to around 160 to 200 kilohertz or 200,000 cycles a second. So they range from infra to ultrasonic, 10 to 12 octaves.
Does it help them pick up smaller objects? Because you said they had to pick up small fish.
Well,
the
smaller the object, the higher the frequency needs to be that they use to echolocate. We should probably make clear that they not only hear like we do, passively or actively listening for sounds. An echolocator puts out a sound, a click, or a tone, and then it analyzes the return echoes, very much like we were just listening to the echoes of the Quetzal.
Right.
Except they're generating that tone and then listening to how it's changed. If the higher the frequency is, the smaller the object that will interfere with that outgoing sound, and therefore the smaller the object you can image in their brain with sound. If you're using low frequencies, you can image big things like Bermuda. we're beginning to wonder if they're not using low frequencies to navigate. So it's not entirely a joke.
All right, well, no, I'm laughing because I'm fascinated. I'm laughing with you. We're going to come back and talk lots more about this. So stay with us. More about acoustics, sonar, Quetzals, other kinds of stuff. Take your questions. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato, and we're talking this hour about acoustics with my guest, Patricia Kuhl, author of The Scientist in the Crib, Minds, Brains, and How Children Learn, David Lubin, president of David Lubin and Associates, and Darlene Catton, who is assistant professor in the Department of Otology and Laryngology at Harvard Med School in Boston. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Patricia Kuhl, you study how infants learn to speak, and your experiments have shown that infants are sophisticated in listening to sounds early in life. Can you give us an idea how early and what you mean by that?
Well, certainly. The truth is that babies are very good in the first moments of life. As soon as we can test them, they've been tested, say, within an hour or two after birth. And up until 6 months, babies are incredibly good at detecting all the distinctions used in the sounds of all languages. And I like to refer to them as citizens of the world because of this. They don't know ahead of time which language they're going to be born into, right? Whether they're going to be born in Japan or the United States or any number of places. And so nature has prepared them by allowing them to distinguish all the sounds of human language, something that you and I can't do.
Wow.
As adults, we're very culture-bound, not citizens of the world anymore, and we hear very well the distinctions of our own language, but we're quite poor at foreign language distinctions. And this change between birth and our age comes very early in life, before the end of the first year.
Mm-hmm. And so they're organizing and rearranging and creating little synapses and connections in their brains very early on?
That's exactly right. The new measures that we have allow us to examine both in behavioral performance and in brain measures that infants are reacting to all the sound distinctions early, and then between 6 months and 12 months, as the brain is beginning to analyze and group sounds that they're exposed to, it's actually a statistical process, they begin to lose the ability to hear the foreign distinctions as their brains focus and tune to the character of the sound that is going to be essential for them at 12 months to learn first words.
So at what point do they start filtering out the other language?
Our earliest measures of change are at about 10 months, between 8 months and 10 months of life. At 8 months, they're still pretty good at hearing all the foreign language distinctions. By 10 months, we get the first evidence that they are beginning to fail to pay attention to it. Doesn't mean that their auditory systems aren't recording that distinction, but they fail to attend to it because they've organized sounds into the categories that are going to be relevant for the words they're going to learn in 2 short months.
1-800-989-8255. Does that explain why it's so easy for kids to learn more languages and more difficult for us?
Well, I think it does. The brain measures are suggesting that as infants, we analyze the incoming sounds. As I say, statistically, there's a number of calculations, in a sense, that they're making. And they're committing the neural networks in the brain to recognizing those particular distinctions because we have to do that in noise. We have to do that in difficult listening situations. So it's important to, in a sense, commit the neural networks to a particular way of listening. And that happens very early.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on. There's so many acoustic, you know, until you look at what's going on at this meeting, you don't realize how much research there is in acoustics to go that's going
true.
On, and we hardly get a chance to cover it. So I'm going to try to go through a couple of other topics quicker, if I can speak correctly. David Lubin, one of your interests is classroom acoustics. And can you give us some examples of how bad acoustics can create poor learning conditions in classrooms?
Oh, yes. Alas, too many bad examples. But Pat Kuhl was really talking about the importance of learning to listen. And what this classroom acoustics topic is about the importance of listening to learning. And so many classrooms are too noisy and too reverberant to understand speech very clearly. It seems amazing, but for reasons I've yet to understand, when the lighting is poor in a classroom, everybody knows it's too dark to learn. But when the acoustics are bad, people just go on and try to muddle through, but they miss a great deal. And some of those who really miss out are those with hearing impairments or certain learning disabilities, and also those who have language disabilities, like non-native listeners. Maybe they're from another country.
You know, you hear concert halls designed for acoustics, but you never hear of a classroom. Maybe a lecture hall or, you know, something like that, but you never hear of an individual classroom that's designed for good acoustics.
There used to be. And after all, think of the word auditorium. Isn't that what it means? A place for listening?
Interesting. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to phones. Lots of people are interested, and maybe we can start talking about acoustics. And in the classroom is Catherine and Mason. Hi, Catherine. Mason, Ohio.
This is exactly what I wanted to talk about. My daughter has auditory and language processing problems, and it's so chaotic and noisy, and especially with this trend towards active learning. We have an amplifier for her in the room, but I was wondering what else can you do because these classrooms aren't designed correctly.
David?
Yes, we don't encourage the amplification. If it's a small classroom, the amplification shouldn't be necessary. It really doesn't do the whole job. It does part of it by making it easier for the students to hear the teacher, but it doesn't necessarily make it easier for the teacher to hear the students, and it doesn't necessarily make it easier for the students to talk to one another to get this informal learning. The best thing is to design the classroom to begin with good acoustics. And the next best thing, it's often more expensive, is to renovate the classroom for good acoustics, to make sure the noise level is low and make sure the reverberation time is low. Usually you do that by having a good acoustic ceiling.
Is there anything to retrofit?
Yes, you can renovate. Do you know, it sounds like there's two problems here. One is the style of learning for this classroom. And it sounds like, in this case, the noise is from other students. It might be that that your child, Catherine, needs a different style of learning rather than this the one that she's is being inflicted on her.
Well, no. I mean, we are lucky in that there is an IEP. She is in a special education, so those criteria are being met. But with the amplification system to get the teacher's voice above the background noise, because she tends to take everything in equally and not pull out the background noise like we would. So that was the reason for the amplification system. But I have this thing about active learning. I think it's very chaotic, very noisy, and I don't necessarily think it's the best for all children.
Patricia, did you want to jump in there?
I did. I was going to comment that we know how important it is that the kind of language that infants and children listen to. They're very keen to listen to the clear kind of emphasized slow language that mothers produce that's gotten the popular name motheries or parenties. And if you record teachers in classrooms talking to their young pupils, you can see that they're using some of these same characteristics. You know, the slow, a little bit sing-song, very emphasized, but clear, articulated speech, and it looks to have an impact on the kids. And I think the improvement of classrooms will involve both the classroom acoustics and teachers' and parents' knowledge of the importance of the kind of language that they provide for their kids, because the brain is trying to map all of these sounds of language and the combinations that are important to them. So I think the study of how we speak to children is very, very important.
Catherine, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Darlene, let's talk a little bit about the current debate over whether naval sonar systems can damage animals, underwater animals like whales and dolphins, their hearing. You've said that, quote, sonar is heavily correlated with whale strandings in both time and space. Does that happen often?
Fortunately, it doesn't happen often. We do know from the historical records, a lot of people have been working on this since it became a very high-profile news item about almost 3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that there have been incidents that clearly we have particularly beaked whales stranding at the same time that there have been extensive sonar exercises. They tend to happen in the same types of places, that is in narrow channels with islands in the vicinity with deep water immediately offshore. And this is a fascinating opportunity and also in a sense a really rewarding opportunity for scientists to contribute. It's not often that we not sometimes get a chance to get both basic research as well as practical needs answered at the same time. Unfortunately, we don't have the answer yet. We need to understand what's happening. The thing that makes it particularly fascinating is it seems to be just beaked whales that are having this problem. What we do know is that it's not direct acoustic impact that's causing the injuries we find in these beaked whales. The reason I say it's important to remember that they're just beaked whales is The incident that brought so much attention around the world was in the Bahamas, and then again just last year in the Canary Islands, in which there was a Spanish exercise. These whales, there are lots of species there, and they all hear in the frequency of the sonar, but it was only the beaked whales that were coming on shore. And we're concerned now that this might have been a disturbance reaction rather than an acoustics reaction directly, not acoustic trauma, but rather a stress-related case. We need to work at this from all angles of physiology and hearing before we really know what's going on with it, but it's going to be an important one to solve.
1-800-989-8255. Russ in San Francisco. Hi, Russ.
Hi. Patricia, this is Russ Hamer from San Francisco.
Hmm.
I'm a former colleague of yours from Seattle.
I thought the name sounded familiar.
You guys catch up later, okay? No.
I wanted to find out if people have figured out where the sense of rhythm is controlled in the brain, you know, maybe from MRI studies. When you hear a sound, obviously the auditory parts of the brain will probably are active, but the perception of rhythm is a completely different
right.
organization of sound.
Right.
I'm wondering about the development of rhythm perception.
Well, we're just beginning to study that. Rhythm is interesting both from the standpoint of music and from the standpoint of language. So it looks as though when the rhythm of a message is musical, the right hemisphere takes over. The right hemisphere, which is this sort of holistic, humanistic part of your brain, seems to light up. And when the rhythm is involved in components related to language, like the meter of and the stress pattern of the language, then the left hemisphere takes over. But these are preliminary results, and how that all develops in early infancy and childhood is one of the forefront questions we're trying to understand. Music and speech are both so important and so tucked into our evolutionary history that understanding the brain mechanisms dedicated to that analysis will be really, really interesting to know.
Interesting. Is it possible to create? We talk a lot about brain imaging and how it's.
Mm-hmm.
You talk in terms of watching the brain light up. Can you create an underwater brain imager for a dolphin, for example, to go into and watch the dolphin's brain light up, or is that too difficult, or is that some waste of time and money to do?
Oh, well, it sounds like a pretty difficult problem.
You can train dolphins to do almost anything, it looks like. Why couldn't they put their head in a little donut, you know, like we do?
Believe me, we'll probably figure it out. We'll probably figure it out. We're now imaging, structural imaging and functional imaging of very young babies. We're watching their brains grow over time and how that brain growth is tied to the environments in which they're in. And we can track learning as in terms of the brain. So I imagine that it will be possible at some time to hook up some kind of device that works underwater. These machines are pretty complicated if you've looked at them, but I have no doubt that our scientists will forge that new territory
sounds
and figure
like
that out.
Sounds like a Navy project to me.
It certainly does.
Can I jump in
sure,
here on
please.
This one, Starling Ketten?
Sure.
As it turns out, some of my work is on humans and imaging, but also on dolphin imaging. In fact, at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, where I have my joint appointment, we now have what we refer to as the Ocean Imaging Center, because under a program for instrumentation, we received a CT scanner, a Siemens scanner in this case, which is exactly like a clinical CAT scanner, and except we refer to it as the Dolph scanner. It's used for imaging dolphins and seals, and in fact, now it's the Ocean Imaging Center, since we're also looking at corals and fish and shrimp, and many of these are live animals. With a CT scanner, we don't look at brain activity per se, but there are several programs going on not only in my lab and in the Boston area, but in California and Hawaii, where we're trying to make use of MR machines, magnetic resonance machines, to do functional imaging just as Pat has just been talking about. Now, they don't quite go underwater, but there is one other thing, and that is we have tags that are put on, that these are electronic devices that monitor the animal, sometimes listening to what sounds it's producing or what sounds are coming to it. We listen to body sounds, heart rate, for instance. They are also depth and orientation mm-hmm. and speed detectors. So we're not yet imaging the brain, but we are getting very close to it.
Let me just jump in and remind everybody that this is Ira Flader, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Patricia Kuhl, David Lubman, and Darlene Kenton. And so you're getting close to where you can have a 24/7 imaging or listening to what's going on in these mammals?
I'd say 24/7 monitoring in a variety of ways. There's something also called a critter cam, where if we link the video of what the animal is doing with the tags and its orientation in the depths, we're getting... One thing about dolphins and whales that's fascinating is, although they're air breathers, they're mammals, no question about it, they actually spend about 80 to 90% of their time underwater. Very little. That's one of the difficulties in understanding what they do, is we don't get much chance to observe them directly. So these really are underwater animals. So we really want to know is exactly what they're doing at depth underwater most of their time. With hearing, a technique that's used with babies, just as Pat just said that babies have this wonderfully plastic brain at birth about speech. We know that their ears develop in utero, so do the dolphins. Mm-hmm. And one of the tests that we use on babies and on dolphins is called auditory evoked potentials or auditory brainstem response. It's a non-invasive way of testing the hearing without having the animal have to be trained. If we can put these surface sensors on the dolphin, just as we do on babies, we can determine what that animal's hearing capability is. And there's a lot of work right now trying to figure out how to put an ABR machine on the back of a swimming whale so we know what its hearing is like in water at depths, mm-hmm. rather than just in captivity on some of the smaller species. You know, it'd be great to get an audiogram, a hearing curve on a blue whale in the ocean at 200 meters.
Is the ocean a noisy place?
Yes. The idea of a silent sea is somewhat frightening to me because that's a dead sea. In fact, one of the biggest producers of noise in the oceans are shrimp. We have shrimp and whales and fish, all of which are producing a lot of sound. Now, of course, this is natural sound, and then on top of that are the physical sounds, waves, seismic activity, volcanoes going off. Man's adding a lot of noise. Nothing personal, gentlemen. Let me make that humans are adding a lot of sound to the ocean now, and that's one thing that we're concerned about. We don't know if there is an impact, and if so, what types of impacts we're bringing into the oceans with pretty much everything that humans do that adds sound.
We're going to take a short break, come back, and talk lots more about sounds in the ocean, acoustics, other sounds, your calls. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about acoustics, the science of sound, with my guest David Lubman, president of David Lubman and Associates in Westminster, California, Darlene Kenton, senior scientist in biology at Woods Hole, Patricia Kuhl, who's professor of speech and hearing sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. David Lubman, I know you and your colleagues are working on developing a national standard for classroom acoustics. What does that mean?
We have it. We have a national standard on classroom acoustics at this time. The American National Standards Institute has promoted the standard, and the Acoustical Society provided the secretariat and most of the participants. It was hugely popular in the Acoustical Society. The number of the standard is S12.60-2002. Isn't that interesting?
Well, no, it's not actually. Well, what does a standard mean? I mean, that's a number. What's in the number?
Sure. Well, for the first time in American history, really, we say that in order to be qualified for learning, a classroom should have when unoccupied, should have a noise level that does not exceed 35 decibels, mm-hmm. and it should have a reverberation time that does not exceed 6/10 of a second.
Mm-hmm. Those are the standards. So you can design it. Is it easier to start over with a classroom and do that, or to retrofit?
It's much less expensive to do it right the first time. And the architects will do it, but only if their customers demand it.
Mm. Give us an idea of what 35 decibels is.
It would be, let's say, a typical living room with little activity going on.
So there is some street noise outside, a little bit of that?
A little bit. You can still hear things, but right. But you can hear speech clearly.
You don't have to scream.
You don't have to scream. The teachers don't have to raise their voice. And when they teach in a classroom that's ANSI qualified, the day ends and they say, gee, for some reason, I don't feel tired.
How many classrooms in America, what percentage do you think at this moment meet that standard?
Probably less than a third. Yeah. Meet that standard now. We don't have good figures on it, but so far as we've been able to find out, less than a third.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Ruben in Stockton, California. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there.
I had a question on if there's been any studies on tones, like in relation to their effect on the human brain. I guess I'm getting at... I've heard something about sounds being addictive to humans.
Addictive. Hmm.
Do you mean tone as in tone languages, or do you mean tone as in just tonal noises in the environment?
Are there any sounds that people are addicted to, I think?
Right. More generally, I guess you could just discuss tones in relation to how they affect the brain. And you know, are there certain tones that would release serotonin?
Good question. Yeah, and maybe certain rhythms. I mean, there are certain tunes, rhythms, you know.
Well, certainly there's an effect of music and sound that we consider very pleasant or very unpleasant on the brain. Mm-hmm. So when noises are disjunctive, when they're too loud, when they sound grating, you can certainly do measures on the brain that indicate that's a negative event. Whereas the sounds of language, the sounds of music, of course, music differs across cultures, languages differ across cultures. We love the sounds of communication. We love the sounds of music. They seem to relax us. So, yes, there's this emotive effect that sound has on the brain, as well as this communicative effect. And it is true that brain studies have the ability to pull those apart and tell us which aspects of the signal we tend to listen to.
And people claim that there are sounds that are healing. That music.
Well, yes, I think there is a claim. Now, I don't think there's scientific evidence yet that particular sounds are themselves what's caused healing, but there is certainly the case that stress levels and cortisol, et cetera, can be diminished by situations in which sound is used to calm us down.
Let's go to Edward in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi, Edward.
Hi, I like the show.
Thank you.
I got a question about infant learning, different kinds of sounds and everything. I was just wondering if an infant is exposed to too many varieties of sounds, does that make it to where they can't exactly specialize on their sounds that are like their native tongue and everything like that? Or
right.
Dr. Cole?
That's a fascinating question. We know, for example, that children are capable of learning 3 and 4 languages. I mean, look at European kids who are regularly exposed to 2 and 3 languages. But we don't know whether or not the learning process has slowed down somewhat. We're now doing a study supported by the Human Frontier Science Program that is operating in 4 countries, Japan, Finland, Sweden, and the United States. And I'm the head of that project. We are looking at kids who are being raised monolingually, just listening to one language, and comparing them to kids who are raised bilingually, where one parent is learning one and one parent is speaking one and the other parent is speaking the second language. Our question is this developmental trajectory that we've established the same in monolingual and bilingual kids, and what is the impact on language at 2, 3, and 4 years of age? Now, the study is just in progress, but it's possible that as the brain tries to commit itself to the sounds of languages, that hearing 2 at once may slow things down a little bit, but the advantage is you're exposing the child when the brain is so plastic and so capable of learning 2 different sets of 2 maps, in a sense, both stored in the brain and making it possible for the child to really acquire 2 native tongues.
Thanks for the call. I'm going to give you, it's rare that I have 3 people on to give the blank checkbook question to, but I'll give it to all 3 of you, and it goes something like this. If I could give you a blank check to conduct any kind of cutting-edge research, basic research, into your field in acoustics, Where would you spend that money? Where would you spend that money?
I think the most important thing in my mind is what we can do to improve American education. I would spend money to both study and improve classroom acoustics, and I would do tests that show the improvement in achievement of students that would show up after just a few years. And when people realized how much better we learn and how much better students are behaved with good acoustics, we would make the necessary investment to do this for all of our schools.
Dr. Kenton?
Well, I divided into three topics. Of course, I'm going to focus on underwater
noise. It's a big check.
Good. It's a big ocean. The most critical thing that we need in the oceans right now is to understand the noise budget of the oceans and what we're doing to it. If you look at places like Rotterdam and Singapore, two of the busiest harbors in the world, the shipping industry is a necessity to us, absolutely, but we don't understand. That's a 24/7 sound addition to the oceans. We need to understand how shipping is affecting the northern oceans compared to the southern oceans, for instance. I was just in Australia talking with some of their oceanographers, and it's a nearly pristine environment compared to what we've got in the northern hemisphere. This has been a big question for the National Academy of Sciences for the last three major panels. What are the effects of noise in the oceans, anthropogenic noise, that is, human-made sounds, and what are we doing in the coastal as well as in the mid-ocean cases? Then the second thing I would do is, as we've already touched on, is to try to develop the technologies so that we could begin to both test and monitor what sounds animals are making, not just the whales and dolphins, which admittedly are fascinating creatures for a lot of reasons and possibly have some of the best ears in the world, or certainly somewhat better than ours. But we also, there's a question about whether or not invertebrates, maybe the last thing a giant squid ever hears is the click that comes out of a sperm whale. Do they hear, or how do those animals sense in the deep ocean?
I mean, we have no idea whether they sense acoustics.
That's right. There's a very intriguing component to squid. They have cells, what are called hair cells, that look very much like auditory ear hair cells, the same cells that we use in our inner ears to sense sound. They have them sitting just under their mantle, that big bellow-like structure on a squid. And we have often thought that invertebrates don't hear, per se, that they don't use sound, as mammals obviously do, as fish do. Invertebrates might very well be hearing in one way or another. It's an entirely new field that we haven't looked into. And then the last thing is to monitor in the very deep oceans. Sight is not the best sensory system underwater. Hearing clearly is a very important one because sound goes much farther and water gives many more cues than light does. Light attenuates very rapidly underwater. What is the importance of sound, not again just to whales and dolphins, but to fish and octopus, squid, things that live in the deep ocean? How do they use sounds? We need to understand what the sound components are, what comes from animals, and it's an entirely new field for exploration. What is sound doing in deep oceans?
I'm sorry. We're talking about acoustics this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And Dr. Kuhl, your blank check goes into
well,
what?
My dream would be to use the new studies on brain science to contribute to education. I think there's so much that we can do. There's a big distance between the neuron and the chalkboard, that's for sure. But that gap is shrinking as we apply these measures, very sophisticated measures, on the brain's reaction to all kinds of environmental stimuli. My favorite, of course, is sound. And trying to understand how brains learn. And I think that the answer to that question will affect broadly how we conduct education in schools, how we think of children in the first 5 years, how we think of adult learning. These are studies that can be done, will influence all of us, all of our lives, and I think are very important.
And what about research into regaining our hearing?
I think
could stem cells help us bring back those dead hair cells?
Stem cells may be important in all kinds of recovery from injury. I mean, that's a brave new world that many scientists really want to head into. And I'm in favor of it because I think that the work to regenerate sensory systems that we think are non-regeneratable and also brain areas that have lost function due to stroke, the more we know about how the brain initially learns, the more we'll understand about how damage to particular neural networks can affect our abilities to do things. And then potentially, what are the methods we can use to recover word-finding abilities in people with aphasia, those who have had strokes? I think those are important lifelong learning questions and will help all of us function better for as long as we live.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time to talk with us this hour. Acoustics is certainly something we should talk more about, and we don't get enough time. And it's fascinating. You know, you go away from a subject, you come back. How many advances there have taken place since you've approached it? So I want to thank all of you for taking time to talk with us. Darlene Ketten is assistant professor in the Department of Otology and Laryngology at Harvard Medical School in Boston, and senior scientist in biology at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Maybe we can get you that underwater MRI machine one of these days. So.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. And if I get it, you'll be the first to know.
Thank you very much. Dr. Patricia Kuhl, you're welcome, is co-author of The Scientist in the Crib, Minds, Brains, and How Children Learn. She is a co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences and the William P. and Ruth Gerberding University Professor and Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. Thank you, Dr. Kuhl, for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Ara.
And giving us the West Coast perspective on us today.
Right.
Also, David Lupman is president of David Lupman and Associates in Westminster, California, and he's also a specialist in acoustics. Thank you for coming into the studio.
It's a pleasure, Ira.
And joining us here in New York this week. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Erica Altman, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer. Our intern is Julie Kalin. And we had help today from engineers Manoli Weatherall in New York and Doug Patterson in Seattle. And also, if you missed, do you like to send us some email? Please surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, you can listen to back editions of Science Friday, download them on your Audible player, or listen to them on Real Audio. You can also leave us email there, or you can write it the old classic way to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street. Make sure you put the fourth floor on that. New York, New York, 10036. And if you missed any of the links we talked about today, you didn't have your pencil ready, surf over to our website there at sciencefriday.com, and Charles has them up ready for you to take advantage of them. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.